Oh, okay. All right.
Give Anastasia 1 second to turn it on. Here she goes.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm opening an organizational meeting for the House Committee on Energy and Environment. So welcome to the very first committee of this session. I am very happy to be here with such a great crew. We're going to start today with just a few housekeeping items, introductions of members and staff, and then we'll go over the rules for the committee. We're not going to have any introduction of committee members measures today, but we'll be doing those in the upcoming meetings. And then we're going to have a wonderful informational meeting just on an overview of the energy, the topic of energy, with a lot of great people coming to talk today. So just to start off, this is my first time as chair of this policy committee, but I've been a member.
Right.
I know. Got a great vice chair. So, but I've been a member of this committee since last session, and really happy to be talking about all the issues that we're going to be looking at this time. Representative from House District 47 in East Portland. So why don't we go ahead and start with the end.
Oh, I'm Dallas Hurd, House District 2. That's Roseburg down to Merlin, which is the side of Grants Pass.
Paul Holby, District 8, South Eugene and Central Lane County.
Cliff Benz, District 60, see one-third of Eastern Oregon, a small fraction of which, if we covered it with solar panels, could power the entire state.
Yes. Amen.
I'm Jeff Reardon, District 48, Outer Southeast Portland, Clackamas, and if we had solar panels, we could protect the homeless.
Me, oh good. Mark Johnson from House District 52. I live in Hood River, so I'm fortunate, and you all wish you lived where I do. I know. So,
actually, no, Representative. I'm Deborah Boone. I represent the beautiful Upper Left Coast, which, if we use the ocean and our rivers to power, we could cover this probably the whole West Coast.
State Representative Jim Widener, House District 24, and we'll send our teenagers out to throw rocks through their solar panels.
I'm Representative Ken Helm, District 34, that's part of Beaverton and Rock Creek, also the neighborhoods of West Haven and Cedar Hills, part of which are in Beaverton, part of which are in Portland.
And I am very happy to have Beth Petrino as the committee administrator. I wanted to get a bath, and I got one, so I'm very happy about that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm happy to be here. Most recently, I've staffed House Ag and Natural Resources, so back to Energy and Environment, and I'm really happy to be here, and whatever I can do to help you, let me know.
Wonderful. Okay, great. And it sounds like our members have given a little preview of some of the topics we'll probably be working on this session, with everybody rooting for their own home district. So let's go ahead and do the committee rules. Beth, do you want to go ahead and give an overview of those?
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, pretty standard set of committee rules. You may have already heard in other committees about the two changes, and if anybody would like me to review those, I'm happy to do that. But basic set of committee rules for the most part.
And you can. Everybody should have a hard copy of the committee rules, and they're also available on OLIS. Just as kind of a going forward thing, we're going to have all the materials available on OLIS and try to be as reliant on electronic copies of materials as possible this session. We'll go ahead and start that with the rules. Any questions? Okay, can I have a motion to adopt the rules?
Chair Vega Peterson, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February the 3rd, 2015.
Okay, Representative Johnson moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 3rd, 2015. Is there any discussion? Any further discussion? All right, and is seeing none, the clerk will call the roll. Do you want to call the roll, or should we just do any opposition?
Do that.
No. Okay. Motion passes and the rules are adopted. Okay. And then I'll go ahead and open the informational meeting on the energy overview. And so let's have our first panel come up. we're going to have, which will be Andy Ginsberg from the Oregon Department of Energy, Jason Eisendorfer from the PUC, and Cristobal from the Bonneville Powell Administration. Welcome. After you get settled, please go ahead and state your name for the record. Welcome, and everyone, you do have a paper copy, but like I said, there's also a version on OLIS for you to review, too.
Chair Vega Peterson, Vice Chairs Reardon and Johnson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Andy Ginsberg. I'm Assistant Director of Planning, Policy, and Technical Analysis at the Oregon Department of Energy. And with me is Jason Eisendorfer, the Utility Program Director at the Oregon Public Utilities Commission. And we're here today to present some information for you on energy that we hope you'll find useful as you consider important energy issues this session. And we're also happy to provide additional information to you as a committee or individually as the session proceeds and questions may come up. Both of our agencies have expert staff, and we're happy to answer technical and policy questions that you might find helpful.
Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee, I'm Jason Eisendorfer of the Public Utility Commission. Just a quick refresher on the PUC, I think next, in 2 days, the chair of the commission and the director of other, we're going to come and talk a little bit about the respective agencies. But the PUC is a three-person commission that oversees the regulation of investor-owned utilities in the state of Oregon, electric utilities, natural gas utilities, telecommunication utilities, and the water utilities. In our section, we have staff that are experts in energy resources and planning, rates, finance, and audit on the telecommunications side, service quality, and on water utilities as well. We have a safety, reliability, and security section, a consumer services section. So I'm going to turn it back to Andy, and he's going to kick off the presentation.
Okay, and before I do, I'll just give a little quick background on ODO. ODO's mission is to reduce the long-term cost of energy, including the economic, social, and environmental costs. And we encourage households and businesses, schools, tribes, and agencies to invest in renewable energy and energy efficiency, and we do that through tax credits, loans, and grants, also providing technical assistance and information, and by helping to advance new technologies through policy development, through public sector practices, and also through pilot programs. We also ensure environmentally sound and safe permitting of energy facilities, and this involves a consolidated permitting process that combines all the local and state permitting standards, and it eliminates the need for multiple permits and decision-making processes and speeds up timelines for energy facilities. And we also provide staff support for a 7-member Energy Facility Siting Council that's appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. In addition, we oversee the cleanup of the Hanford nuclear site, and we provide emergency preparedness for nuclear accidents and petroleum shortages. And our agency is funded by a mix of funds, federal funds, fees, and energy supplier assessment, and we get no general fund. So turning to our presentation, I'm going to begin with some highlights of Oregon's energy profile, and then I'll talk about some of the major energy players in our region. Then Jason will cover Oregon's energy regulatory framework for electricity primarily, and then we'll each highlight some of the key market drivers and policy drivers that will affect our energy future. So starting with how Oregon uses energy, electricity counts for about 40% of the energy we use for everything from appliances and lighting to heating and cooling. But while we'll be focusing mainly on electricity today, I want to touch on the other forms of energy because energy isn't just about electricity. We also use substantial amounts of energy for transportation and as well as for thermal energy, meaning for heating. So as you can see in this illustration, there's an overlap among these different sources of energy. Electricity can be used to heat our homes. It can be used to power vehicles. Natural gas can be used to generate electricity. It can also be used directly for heating. And it increasingly can be compressed and used for transportation fuel. So focusing specifically on electricity, From 2010 to 2012, Oregon used about 47 million megawatt hours of electricity per year, about half of which came from renewable energy sources. So this chart represents consumption and not production. So we're talking about energy compiled from all of the utilities in the state, and it includes energy generated both in-state and out-of-state for use in Oregon. About half of the electricity is met by hydropower. About half of our electric demand is met by hydropower, and about a third is met by coal, and then only about 5% comes from wind. Of the coal slice, PGE's Boardman plant accounts for 4.5% of the state total, and the remainder of that is electricity that we import from coal plants from out of state. And while our electricity resource mix hasn't changed much in the last 5 years, we do expect the coal portion to begin to decline as coal plants throughout the region either close or reduce generation in response to federal regulations that Jason will talk about later, and also changes in market conditions. And we also expect the renewable slice to increase as the renewable portfolio standard begins to ramp up this year and in 2020 and 2025. So this chart shows the energy used for residential and commercial and industrial heating, as well as industrial process heat. Thermal heat can be supplied by electricity. It also can come from fuels such as natural gas, oil, and propane. And it can also come from renewables such as biomass, solar, and geothermal. And overall, thermal energy accounts for about a quarter of our energy use in Oregon for space and process heating. Industrial process heat accounts for half of the thermal energy we use, and also half of the energy that industry uses is thermal, so it's pretty significant in that sector. And combined heat and power, otherwise called CHP or cogeneration, is one strategy that we can use to improve efficiency of the thermal energy use and electric generation at industrial facilities by combining them and generating them both at the same time. Our department is implementing a federal grant to advance thermal energy efficiency and combined heat and power for industry by providing some tools and technical support for industry. Then looking at transportation, gasoline and diesel dominate the transportation portfolio, but biodiesel and ethanol are significant contributors thanks to the renewable fuel standard. Between 2005 and 2013, overall transportation fuel consumption decreased by 115 million gallons per year, while the proportion of non-petroleum fuels increased from a little over 1.5% to over 8% today. So now, turning to some of the major players in energy in our region, this map illustrates the service territories of Oregon's 40 electric utilities. And we usually break down utilities into two major categories. There's utilities that have shareholders and are for-profit organizations, and those are called investor-owned utilities. And then we have utilities that are run by their customers, which are called consumer-owned utilities. The Public Utility Commission, represented here by Jason, regulates the investor-owned utilities. The consumer-owned utilities have oversight from their boards. Consumer-owned utilities are in the colored part of this map, and they're organized into three different types. There's people's utilities districts, cooperatives that are managed by their members, and then municipalities. In Oregon, the vast majority of utilities are consumer-owned utilities, but collectively they only represent about 30% of the electricity consumed in our state. Investor-owned utilities are in the white space on this map. In Oregon, we have three: Portland General Electric, Pacific Power, and Idaho Power. And the investor-owned utilities collectively make up two-thirds of electric sales and three-quarters of electricity customers. PGE's territory is concentrated in the northern I-5 corridor of the white area there on the map. They represent about 37% of all electricity sales in Oregon. Idaho Power is the white area to the east. They are less than 2% of sales. And then PacifiCorp represents the remaining white areas on the slide and on the map, and they comprise 28% of sales. There are also electricity providers in Oregon that don't have service territories. They're called electricity service suppliers. They can provide electric service to non-residential customers of investor-owned utilities through a framework called Direct Access. So turning to natural gas, there are three investor-owned natural gas utilities operating in Oregon. They reported collective sales of 858 million therms during 2013. Northwest Natural Gas is our largest natural gas distribution utility. They serve 80% of customers in the state. Cascade Natural Gas serves 8% of customers, and Avista serves 12% of customers. You can also see on this map that there are large areas that have no natural gas service. These areas are mainly rural, and they rely on electricity, wood, oil, and propane for heat. The Bonneville Power Administration is a federal marketing power administration under the U.S. Department of Energy, and Crystal will be telling you more about that in a moment. But I'll just say briefly now, BPA markets power from federal dams in the Columbia River system, equal to about 30% of the region's firm energy. And they also market power from the Columbia Generating Station nuclear plant in Washington. BPA provides low-cost cost-based rates to utilities in the region, and consumer-owned utilities have preference to the low-cost hydropower of the federal hydropower system. BPA is also the largest owner and operator of electricity transmission lines in the Northwest, that's shown on this chart. They represent three-fourths of the region's transmission system. To mitigate impacts of the federal dams, BPA provides substantial funding for fish and wildlife programs in the Columbia River Basin, and they also operate the core energy efficiency programs for their consumer-owned utility customers. The Northwest Power and Conservation Council was established by the Northwest Power Act to plan for power, fish, and wildlife in the Northwest. The council is made up of two members from each of the four states in the Columbia River Basin: Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Montana. The Northwest Power Act directs the council to develop a 20-year regional plan to assure that the Northwest has an adequate and economic supply of power. And the council is required to update that plan every 5 years. One reason this plan is so significant is that BPA resources must be developed consistent with the Power Council's plan. The sixth plan, which was published in 2010, had an important finding that much of the region's electricity load growth can be met over the next 20 years with energy efficiency. And this is important because it affirms the investments that we've made in energy efficiency, which is the least cost zero emission resource that we have available. And as Jason will explain, the energy efficiency is also going to pay dividends for compliance with federal regulations on carbon emissions from power plants, and Oregon is well positioned to comply with that rule thanks to our investments in energy efficiency. So the process for developing the seventh plan is well underway, with PUC and ODO actively engaging to ensure that the plan lays out a solid roadmap for our region to meet our energy goals, accurately assesses the potential for energy efficiency, and also considers the effects of federal regulations. So now I'm going to turn it over to Jason to talk about the regulatory framework in Oregon.
You're going to keep driving.
Okay.
Representative Johnson.
Andy, can I ask you a quick question? We do have a couple new committee members that haven't been a part of these discussions before, but could you explain why hydro isn't considered part of the renewable portfolio for Oregon?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Johnson, hydropower is a renewable energy source. It's not the existing hydropower was not included in the renewable portfolio standard, primarily because that standard was intended to incent new investments in renewable energy.
Thank you.
Thanks, Andy. Members of the committee. So I'm going to give you an overview of the state regulatory framework. And so necessarily, this is going to be a very high level look, and I'm really just going to hit the high points. I'm going to start with
integrated resource planning. So Andy just a moment ago talked about the seventh plan coming out of the Northwest Power and Conservation Act. That is a regional look, a look at the entire Northwest. It doesn't actually, it's very helpful and very informative, but resource decisions actually happen at the utility level. And so at the Public Utility Commission, we ask the six energy utilities, the three electrics and the three natural gas utilities, every 2 years to provide an integrated resource plan. And that plan is a 20-year look. The utility is asked to forecast load over that 20-year period and try to determine what the best combination of resources to serve that load might be. Ultimately, the goal of the integrated resource plan is to identify the least cost, least risk way of serving customers. So least cost is maybe sort of obvious. Least risk, the risks that the utilities are looking at and trying to figure out what the optimum set of resources to serve load is, can be variations in load itself, can be volatile commodity prices. One of the big risks that the Public Utility Commission and the utilities are looking at now are future environmental regulations, either regulations that come out of the Oregon legislature or Congress, or regulations that I guess statutes that come from you guys and statutes that come from Congress and regulations that come from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. That is a significant species of risk that the IRPs actually look at. There is a five-year action plan. That's where the rubber meets the road. In the 3 to 5 year period, as a part of the IRP, the utilities are looking at near-term resource investments. The commission ultimately will acknowledge or not acknowledge that plan. It doesn't really have any rate-making import to it, except down the road when those resources come online and go into rate base. So this next picture is, as good an example of what an IRP can do. This is a graph from PGE's 2013 IRP that was acknowledged in 2014. And it's not so much to show you PGE's circumstances, but really show you the basics of what the IRP is attempting to do. You can see the layers of the birthday cake are the resources that PGE has currently. There's coal, gas, hydro or contract hydro, energy efficiency is a part of that. So the layer cake are those slices that you see. The red line going up is the forecasted load over this 10-year period. There's a couple of things that we're taking away from this. If you sort of squint, you can see that in the contract hydro, that slice of the cake tends to shrink a little bit, and that is because there are some sizable hydroelectric contracts that PG has now that are going to expire at some point. And then if you look at the 2020 to 2021 time frame, you can see the Boardman coal plant coming offline. If you look up from that point between those two resource actions, you can see a gap between the resources that PGE has and the load that they are expecting. And those are the kinds of decisions that ultimately the utility, their customers, and the commission have to grapple with over time prior to when we get to that point. And one other quick point is if you look in the 2016-2017 area, you can actually see resources bump over the red line, the load area. And that indicates a couple of resources coming online. There's the Tucannon Wind Farm, also the Cardi Natural Gas Plant. And both, whether they're coming on or whether they're coming off, resources are generally quite large and they're pretty lumpy. So you build in chunks and you take things off in chunks. Energy efficiency. Energy efficiency, cost-effective energy efficiency is by definition cheaper than the alternative resource compared to, actually, it's maybe 4 or 5 cents per kilowatt hour up to 9 cents per kilowatt hour what the utility could go out and get into the market or through a new resource. Energy efficiency is applied to all customer groups, residential, commercial, industrial, irrigation process, and consists of things like insulation, refrigeration, lighting is quite important. The Energy Trust of Oregon runs the energy efficiency programs for PGE and PacifiCorp and Cascade and Northwest Natural Gas. The Energy Trust is overseen, in addition, by the Public Utility Commission, and there are a number of points of contact that the Commission has with the Energy Trust and requires the Energy Trust to undergo annual financial audits, periodic management audits. The PUC is engaged in the budgeting process of the PUC. Chair Ackerman will talk a little bit more about that on Thursday. And then BPA, Crystal, I'm sure, will talk a little bit about the energy efficiency programs built into rates that the consumer owns use. And as a result, the Northwest and Oregon in particular have a very robust energy efficiency program. So here I'm going to spend a couple of minutes trying to hit some high points of the various energy policies that we have. And we've grouped them into four separate groups, hoping to find some themes associated with them. The first theme is the renewable energy development standards. These are minimum standards applied to the utilities for the acquisition of certain types of resources, in this case, renewables. The RPS applies to all the utilities, all the electric utilities in the state, but it applies different standards depending upon the size of the utility. So the three largest utilities in terms of share of total load are PGE, PacifiCorp, and Eugene Water and Electric Board. The goal in the RPS is to have 25% of their load served by renewable energy in 2025. There are two other utility sizes, and one is 5% by 2025, and the other is 10% by 2025. Eligible renewable energy resources are wind, solar, wave, geothermal, some biomass. Eligible resources are those developed after 1999, which goes primarily to Representative Johnson's question. Those hydro resources built prior to that point don't count. However, efficiency upgrades to hydro would count toward the RPS. And the other is the solar capacity standard. This is a standard that only applies to the large or to the investor-owned utilities and is looking at large solar investments. Solar and renewable incentives. These are direct financial payments or arrangements with customers to influence renewable resource investments. Net metering is best described by if I have a solar panel on my house and it is generating electricity, net metering allows me to net out what I am actually buying from the utility. So if theoretically I were to be able to generate as much as I would otherwise buy from the utility, I would net out to zero. The Energy Trust has grants through the Public Purpose Charge. The Public Purpose Charge helps fund energy efficiency for the PGE and PacifiCorp, but there's also 17% of that charge goes to fund renewable energy projects and incentives, and the current focus is on irrigation, hydro, biopower, solar, and wastewater treatment plants. And then finally, the solar volumetric incentive pilot only applies to the IOUs, and it's a form of feed-in tariff that is a long-term contract for the output of solar energy. Those feed-in tariffs can apply to small, medium, or sort of larger programs. Okay. Fourth one is the voluntary renewable energy programs. Senate Bill 1149 from 1999 did a number of things. One of the things it did was instruct the investor-owned utilities to offer renewable options for their customers. PGE and PacifiCorp are number one and two in the country in terms of participants, and this allows folks to pay a little bit more for these options to support renewable energy. There's also a voluntary renewable energy tariff in HB 4126 that was just passed in the short session, and there the commission is determining whether or not the utility should begin offering these optional programs to larger industrial and commercial customers. And then finally, the greenhouse gas reductions policies, the emissions performance standard applies to the electric utilities again, and it is a prohibition against the electric utilities buying baseload long-term contracts from resources that have a carbon profile that is dirtier than an inefficient gas plant. So basically what it's saying is you can't enter into a five-year contract with a coal plant on a going-forward basis. And the and voluntary greenhouse gas program is Senate Bill 844. I might let Gary Bauer talk a little bit about that from Northwest Natural when he gets up here. That's a pretty unique program that allows natural gas utilities to come forward with projects that benefit customers generally, but also show specific reductions in greenhouse gases. Okay, so that was the overview. I'm almost done with my part, and I'll turn it back over to Andy, but I'm going to kick off with just, I think, three slides on some of the major drivers that Andy and I deal with on a daily basis. The first one is natural gas prices. Right now, we are in a significantly low period of natural gas price. This chart goes up to 2013. As 2014 gas prices are about in the same place. There's a couple of things you can take away from this graph. One is that right now, with gas prices so low, new renewables have a difficult time competing with gas resources primarily. Renewables themselves don't have any commodity costs, but the capital costs of building renewables and makes it, given where gas prices are, makes the comparison disfavorable to renewable energy. Either even some natural gas energy efficiency measures that aren't making the cost effectiveness cut. The other thing you can take away from this is if you look at the peaks in 2006 and 2000 and between 2008 and 2009, those peaks are something on the order of four times where gas prices are now. So that volatility really indicates the value of both energy efficiency and renewable energy. When those peaks happen, energy efficiency and renewable energy that don't rely on the commodity market provide a really very significant hedge for customers as natural prices bounce around a little bit. Environmental requirements and regulations, this is that risk that I mentioned earlier. Currently, the EPA has promulgated regulations for mercury and haze. These are ongoing. These apply primarily to coal plants. These can have an extremely significant cost impact on coal. Complying with mercury and haze could require $150 million investment for existing coal plants in various kinds of scrubbers. The other major regulation that you may be paying attention to right now is the proposed 111D regulation. This is the EPA proposed regulations to reduce or to set carbon dioxide standards from existing electricity generating units. Basically, what the EPA did was to create standards on a state-by-state basis, and they did it by using sort of groupings. What's the word I'm looking for?
Blocks.
Four blocks, three of which are really pertinent to Oregon. The first one is transitioning coal resources to gas. The second one is additional renewable energy on the system, and the third is energy efficiency. And when you look back at the five-minute overview of Oregon's energy policies, we're actually in a very, very good position to be able to comply with the draft regulations if EPA doesn't do something dumb. And so I just want to condition that statement on whether or not the EPA does something dumb when they finalize the rule at the end of next summer. So the final rule is expected in the summer of this year, and then state compliance plans a year after that.
And committee, just to let you know, we will be having a hearing on 111D to get more information on this during this session. That'll be one of the things we're talking about, as well as a lot of the energy incentive programs that Jason was talking about earlier.
Okay, so my final slide here is on renewable energy integration. Every utility has to balance its load with its supply. They have to make sure they have sufficient resources to meet their demand. And if they don't have sufficient resources to meet their demand, the lights go out. So it is a constant struggle it's a pretty amazing trick that utilities do to make supply meet that demand. Renewable energy, some forms of renewable energy, wind and solar, operate when their resource fuels them. So in those cases, wind and the sun. And so they're generally referred to as variable energy resources. This tends to make that balancing between resources and load a little bit trickier. So there's a couple of tools out there that are being developed. One of them is the energy imbalance market. The energy imbalance market is an automated market that invites generating resources in the region to bid most efficiently balance that supply and demand. PacifiCorp has joined an EIM with the California ISO. The PUC has oversight over PacifiCorp, and there's a couple of filings in front of the commission right now where we're looking at the costs and benefits of that proposal. And the Northwest Power Pool, this is also something I'm sure Crystal will talk about, is assessing the viability of basically an EIM in the Northwest. So back to Andy.
Okay, so we only have two slides left. This is kind of continuing what Jason was just talking about, the principle that the electric grid that generation has to match demand in real time. And of course, as Jason mentioned, one of the challenges of bringing new renewables is online is managing the variability of generation and the variability of load. So in addition to the EIM, energy storage can be a buffer between generation and load, which provides flexibility to system operators and also can smooth that generation, build resiliency into our distribution system, and provide backup power for emergencies. The size and location of energy storage can vary from backups in homes to pumped storage hydro providing grid-level services and battery backup systems on substations. So while energy storage is currently quite expensive, we expect that prices will come down as technology advances, and it will become increasingly easy to integrate into utility systems at lower costs. Our agencies, PUC and ODO, hosted a successful energy storage workshop last March. And following the workshop, ODO secured a federal grant put a demonstration project here in Oregon. So, and then lastly, we want to talk about the energy assurance or energy resilience system. And Oregon is increasingly aware of our vulnerability to tsunamis and earthquakes, but there's other large-scale impacts to be concerned about, and those include things like wildfires, rising ambient temperatures, extreme weather events, and decreasing water availability that can all affect our power system. So a resilient power system is one that is better equipped to withstand those challenges. And so some of the options we have are distributed generation. Another strategy would be using energy generation that doesn't rely on large water cooling systems that could be vulnerable to changes in hydrology and temperature. And also things like smarter grids, alternative fuels, and energy storage can all have resiliency benefits if they're targeted properly. All of these strategies have benefits today in addition to their benefits in the case of an emergency or grid disruption. And we're exploring ways to encourage resiliency through our incentive programs and our partnerships. In 2012, ODO, in partnership with Dogami and PUC, wrote the Statewide Energy Assurance Plan. And that effort complements important work by other energy resiliency and emergency preparedness organizations to help Oregon adapt to a changing climate and prepare for disasters and other emergencies. So with that, we would be happy to answer any additional questions you might have.
I don't see any questions, so thank you so much.
One right here.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Too close.
Too far away, yep.
Jason, I would like to go back to the first slide. It talks about the mission of the PUC, mm-hmm. where you say that the mission is to ensure that safe and reliable utility services are provided to consumers at just and reasonable rates. How do you and or PUC define what is a just and a reasonable rate for energy?
That's easily asked and not so easily answered. Chair Baker Peterson, Representative Johnson, we do go through frequently 9 and 10 month long rate cases, and in those rate cases they are open to stakeholders, and so the utility will file that rate case, and it's open to other stakeholders, including consumer advocates. So my staff will then take a role in that and try to participate as well. And it is there are quantitative issues, there are qualitative issues, there are issues of the utility earning a reasonable investment. There are issues of low income. There are potentially environmental issues. So it's a hard question to ask. We take the commission is going to ultimately have a whole bunch of issues on its table, and it's very much of a balancing act.
One follow-up.
Sure.
I can understand how you probably can factor in foreseen economic trends, population growth, things that happen in the economy to factor in loads and demands and so forth. But how do you factor for developments like, let's say, accelerating the timetable for eliminating coal from our electrical generating portfolio? Obviously, that would have a pretty significant impact on rates. That makes your job pretty difficult, but do you rely upon some sort of modeling or whatever to factor that in and, again, be able to keep a handle on not only what's happening today, but what could happen 5 to 10 years from now?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Johnson, yes, the integrated resource plan is where we would do a lot of that. So there would be a number of different scenarios and a number of different inputs. That is a place where, for example, a party could ask the utility to model that very scenario.
Okay.
And of course, there's a lot of assumptions that go into those models, and those assumptions may go in one direction or another. But it's precisely in that integrated resource plan where we this is a little bit of a sandbox, and parties come in and say, model this or model that. And it is a pretty amazing process, and it is enormously helpful, and it leads to generally pretty good decision-making. Not all states engage IRPs like Oregon does. We take it pretty seriously.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Yes.
Representative Reardon.
Yeah. I think I probably know the answer, but could you just elaborate? Well, I'll just say it's for the new members. How the interaction of the RPS and the IRP processes, how they relate to each other.
Sure. Chair Baker Peterson, Representative Reardon. There's a bunch of things go into the IRP. So when the utility is planning for the load that has been forecasted over the next 20 years, one of the givens that they plan for is meeting and complying with the RPS. Their scenarios will all show them in compliance with the RPS over time. There are different ways to get there, but an IRP run that doesn't comply with the RPS is not particularly helpful to the Public Utility Commission. A similar example is when the Energy Trust is trying to determine how much energy efficiency on an annual basis it should be going out and getting, it sits down with the utility, and they, the Energy Trust and the utility will work through their IRP to figure out what the optimal amount of energy efficiency would be to serve customers. So there's a lot of different inputs. The RPS is an assumed part of that so that the utility ultimately will comply with that law.
So once the standard is set, once the standard is set, it's up to utilities to figure out how to meet that standard.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Great. Thank you both very much. Go ahead.
Okay. And if you wouldn't mind when we get my slides up. Okay. I just have a few.
Okay, and these are available on OLIS.
Sorry. All right. That looks like me.
Yes.
Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee, my name is Crystal Ball. I'm the Oregon liaison at the Bonneville Power Administration, and thanks for the opportunity to talk with you today about BPA. Andy, can you change? Thanks. I think what Jason and Andy have tried to describe is a very unique power system. And one of the reasons it's so unique is because we have this incredibly big river, the Columbia River, and it flows down a very steep hill. And the river has been developed for the public good, and it gives the Northwest an environmental and economic advantage that is unmatched in any part of the nation. U.S. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt believed that the development of the Columbia River could create a better quality of life for people in the Northwest. He thought providing power at cost of production and not for profit would bring down a major economic barrier for people in the Northwest. His core vision is reflected in BPA's vision today. We are an engine of the Northwest's economic prosperity, and our actions advance a reliable, low-cost power and transmission system. Congress created BPA in 1937 to market the power produced by the federal dams and deliver that power to public utilities. The Columbia River is an indigenous resource, and federal laws create preference to the power resource for the people of the Northwest. Today, about 140 not-for-profit consumer-owned utilities buy power directly from BPA under 20-year contracts. In Oregon, these preference customers, as Andy mentioned, include electric cooperatives, municipalities, and people's utility districts. Investor-owned utilities do not buy power directly from BPA, but residential customers of utilities like PGE and Pacific Power in Oregon, they receive a share of the benefit of the Columbia River power system through a program called the Residential Exchange, which lowers electricity rates. Some large industries, other federal agencies, and tribal governments also buy power from BPA. And the BPA transmission system is the region's electric backbone. Over 15,000 circuit miles of BPA high-voltage transmission lines crisscross the Northwest, moving power from where it's generated to where it's consumed. And the federal resource is a major component of Oregon's electricity mix. Hydropower from the federal dams and nuclear power from the Columbia Generating Station make up the bulk of BPA's resource mix. BPA buys a small percent of non-specified power on the open market to balance resources and to meet demands beyond what the federal system can provide. The federal hydropower system is incredibly low cost. It's the envy of the rest of the nation. Montana, Idaho, Washington, and Oregon all have electric rates lower than the U.S. average and substantially lower than our neighbors in the South in California. And there's another benefit of the federal system that fortunately we can't see. And that benefit is clean air. This incredible hydro system produces energy with very low CO2 emissions. And if we didn't have the federal system, we might have 15 coal plants to serve the energy needs of the four-state region. And we continue to take advantage of this resource by conserving it. As Andy mentioned, the 1980 Northwest Power Act stimulated the Northwest's legacy of leadership in energy conservation. And the act required the Northwest Power and Conservation Council to give greater than equal weight to conservation as a generation resource. Today, energy efficiency is the Northwest's second largest resource, and it is far and away the lowest cost, lowest risk resource that we can invest in. BPA collects funds for the energy efficiency program in its rates, and utilities receive incentives when they report energy savings. Working with BPA, Public Power has exceeded the council's targets for energy efficiency. And in the last decade, we've seen significant growth in renewable resources like wind. This has been an opportunity to add new resources to the Northwest mix, but it's also increased the need for balancing reserves. As Jason mentioned, you have to match the electricity from the supply to the demand. And there are currently over 4,700 megawatts of installed wind capacity in BPA's balancing authority. Integrating the output of new energy resources requires expanding balancing capabilities. And to do that, we are working on developing and enhancing operational tools and technologies, basically doing more with what we have, and exploring the potential participation in a Northwest energy imbalance market. For over 75 years, the Federal Columbia River Power System has been an economic driver for our region and helped preserve our environment. It's what makes the Northwest Power System unique, and it's what fuels our way of life. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have about BPA. Representative Benz.
Thank you. Thank you, Crystal, for the presentation. Do you know the number or the cost of all the fish recovery work we've been doing? Can you tack that on to what the other cost is? Just maybe a percentage of the total ratepayers bill.
Yes, I think I can do that. Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Benz, we have spent about $13 billion on mitigating for the impacts of the federal dams in the Columbia River Basin. I think what we say is it's about a third of the ratepayers' bill. So if they did not have to fund those programs, their bill would be about a third lower than it is today.
Follow-up. And do you anticipate that this is a continuing cost, that everyone should be anticipating that nothing's going to change, we'll continue to spend that amount of money to try to recover the fish?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Benz, yes, I do expect that will continue, that BPA will continue to fund that. The Power Council does do the energy efficiency that we've talked about, but it also has a fish and wildlife program, and BPA follows the council's program.
Final follow-up. Mm-hmm. We, of course, have worked on the treaty negotiations with Canada over the past number of years.
Yes.
We haven't heard a peep out of anyone. Perhaps this is a chance for you to share with us what you've worded out.
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Benz, the reason why you haven't heard a peep is we haven't heard a peep from the State Department. So over a year ago, we sent a recommendation to the State Department for the discussion with Canada about the Columbia River Treaty, and we are waiting to hear back from the State Department.
Thank you.
And for the new members of the committee, Representative Benz we had a bill just acknowledging the fact that we are going forward with the new Columbia River Treaty, which was great. And in terms of, I had the opportunity last summer to do a tour of the Bonneville Dam and see what the work that they've done in terms of the fish recovery programs, and it's pretty impressive. So we may have a hearing on that later if we have some time. That's great. Anything else? Okay, thank you all so much for your testimony. The next panel we're going to come up will be the IOUs, so Varner Seaman from BGE, Scott Bolton from PacifiCorp, and Gary Bauer from Northwest Natural.
Mine squeaks.
Welcome, gentlemen.
It's fighting me. Oh, there we go.
There's a lever.
Yeah. Go ahead and have a seat. And when you're ready, go ahead and introduce yourself for the record. And it looks like we have a couple of presentations on OLIS, not Varner.
I'll run yours for you.
The newbie goes first.
Good afternoon, Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Varner Seaman. I'm manager of government affairs for Portland General Electric. Thanks very much for your time today, and welcome to House Energy Environment for 2015. First off, a quick note on Portland General Electric, and I won't belabor too much some of the slides that were talked about earlier, but PGE is the largest utility here in Oregon. We serve over 80,000 customers in 52 cities. Our service territory comprises over 4,000 square miles of land here in the state of Oregon, and we represent about 70% of the gross domestic product here in the state of Oregon. So we think we have a pretty important role to play in the growth of the state and what the economic viability of our state is going forward. I want to talk a little bit today about carbon in particular and about climate issues especially. And first off, talking a little bit about Oregon as we're situated relative to the rest of the country. And I think one of the things that's remarkable about the state of Oregon is we have in the electrical sector one of the lowest emissions, cleanest mixes of power within the electrical sector nationally. Looking up a couple weeks ago at some of the federal data, we're about fifth from the bottom in terms of the carbon intensity and the emissions per capita in the state of Oregon. At the same time, unlike some other states, we've maintained relatively low cost electricity for our customers here in the state of Oregon. So I think that what's unique about Oregon's mix is we're both a combination of low cost and low carbon. And I think that that's something that we should feel pretty good about and something we should take some pride in. And what I want to talk about in my comments today is some of this is going to be a little bit covering some of the ground that's been covered before, but with a little bit different focus on it. I think that a couple weeks ago, I was reading an article where some students from one of the schools in Portland were coming down to the Capitol and looking at carbon issues, and there was an interview of one of the students, and I was, you know, it was cool to see students coming down to the Capitol and spending time here. And one of the students had a quote, and he said, we should do something about carbon. We should do something about climate change. And I thought to myself, well, yeah, we should. And I thought it was a little bit remarkable that the student thought that we weren't doing anything or that had that concern. So I want to talk a little bit about some of the programs and the policies that we have in the state and highlight them. I'm going to first start talking about things that we're doing, particularly at PGE, and then some things in state law and then some things in federal law. So first, for Portland General Electric, and I think Jason and Andy talked about it in their slide earlier, the number one thing that we want to talk about in terms of carbon emission reductions for Portland General Electric is the planned closure by 2020 of the Boardman Coal Plant. So by December 31st, 2020, here in the state of Oregon, we will no longer burn coal to produce electricity. As we look at the emissions projections and looking at the slide that Jason put up from the Integrated Resource Plan for PGE, we're on track by 2025 to have emissions that are 17% lower in 2025 than our emissions were in 2005. So saying that again, we're going to have from 2005 to 2025 over a 20-year period of time a 17% reduction in our carbon emissions. Next thing I want to talk about is PGE, like a lot of utilities across the country, has switched from having meters that need to be read to having automated meters, sometimes referred to as smart meters. That does a couple of different things. It allows us to get a better picture in terms of people's energy use. It allows customers to look at data in more real time or short-term time in terms of what their energy usage is and to take some behavioral changes to lower the amount of energy that people use in their homes. It's also allowed us to cut 1.2 million miles of vehicles traveled for having folks go around and reading those meters. It's something that folks don't often think about when we look at metering technology, but I think it has a pretty beneficial impact in terms of just straight up emission reductions and fewer vehicle miles traveled, reduced congestion. Next, this one gets a little bit into state law, but we want to brag about it under PGE section anyway, that we are number one in terms in the country in terms of our voluntary renewable energy programs. We like to put it in the PGE category because we have a team of folks that works very hard in recruiting customers to sign up for voluntary purchases of renewable energy, and we work very hard to market those programs, and we're very proud to be number one and not number two, Pacificorp. Additionally, PGE is currently engaged here in Salem in a storage pilot project for the Salem Smart Center, where we're doing a grid-level battery storage project for folks on this committee. I'd be happy to invite any of you to come out and do a tour of that facility. It might be an interesting field trip for the committee at some point. Then, as we go on, talk a little bit about state law. One of the things that I think is occasionally, and I saw it in some of the different analysis around a carbon tax, and we take some degree of issue with it, people sometimes talk about carbon policy as only those things, a carbon tax or a price on carbon, and not talking about other policies that have the impact of reducing carbon. And I think that as we go through and we look at our work on renewable energy, that's one of those areas where when you're adding renewable energy into the grid, as we talk about keeping the grid in balance, if you're putting renewables online, you're backing off some other resource. In our resource stack, we're backing off fossil generation. So first off, and we look about state policy for carbon reduction, the Renewable Portfolio Standard is a very important policy for carbon reductions in the state of Oregon. In Oregon, with our 25% by 2025 RPS, that's one of the strongest renewable portfolio standards in the country. PGE is on track, and we intend to physically comply with the RPS by 2025. As Jason referenced, we just brought online last month the Two Cannon River Wind Farm in Washington State, and we're very excited. That's our second owned wind generation facility. We have two under contract. Oregon is also a leader in energy efficiency programs. What was discussed in 1999 with passage of Senate Bill 1149 with the establishment of the Energy Trust of Oregon. Customers of ours contribute significant amounts of money through the public purpose charge that go to energy efficiency programs that have a pretty significant impact in terms of reductions of emissions. We also, through the public purpose charge, fund school efficiency upgrades, low-income payment assistance, and weatherization. I think one of the things that just as a note that's sort of interesting is lower-income customers in our system generally have lower quality housing stock and spend about 20% more on bills than folks who are comparably situated who are higher income. So getting that money into low-income weatherization does have an impact in terms of the amount of energy that we need to generate, the amount of energy we need to use, and has an impact in terms of carbon. As well, at Portland General Electric, we're big supporters of vehicle electrification. Here in Oregon, we are per capita one of the top five states in terms of EV adoption. The numbers and total numbers are still relatively low at about 5,000 vehicles on the road here in Oregon, but we think that this is an important area going forward. PGE has had an important role in terms of putting not just the charging stations outside the Capitol here in the parking garage downstairs, but participating in work to have charging stations up and down the I-5 corridor. And I think that hopefully we'll be seeing some discussions as we go through this session about how do we broaden electric vehicle deployment and make it a little bit more of a middle-class, accessible resource for folks. Next, I want to talk about plant efficiency upgrades. I think one of the things that when we talk about being good stewards, it's how do we use the existing power plants more efficiently? How do we get as much power out as possible? And I think one of the things that we've been working on at PGE is with our existing hydro fleet that's part of our generation mix, making sure we're getting as much zero-carbon power out of those facilities as possible and making those upgrades. As well, I think what hasn't been highlighted earlier is that folks should be aware of on this committee is the Climate Trust. We have in law in Oregon that if you build a new fossil-generating resource, for instance, the Cardi plant that was discussed earlier or the Port Westward 2 plant that PGE just brought online also last month, the company that brings those on or the party that brings forward that fossil generation has to make investments through the Climate Trust and offsets for the emissions associated with those fossil resources. And then next, there is the emissions performance standard that we have in law. There was an update passed in 2013 to the emissions performance standard. And in essence, what that means is there is a prohibition for bringing any new coal or baseload coal online for utilities in the state of Oregon. Finally, in terms of state policy, we've got solar policies, including the solar capacity standard that was discussed, feed-in tariff, and net metering. So as you go through that fairly lengthy list of policies, I think that it's very difficult in my mind to make an argument that Oregon has not taken action in terms of taking positive steps to reduce our carbon footprint. So again, for Portland General Electric, when we look forward, our anticipation is and our planning points to reducing the amount of carbon emissions on a per capita basis and reducing the amount of emissions on a total basis for our system as we go forward. And that's something that we think we're pretty proud about and we think the state of Oregon should be pretty proud about. And then finally, in terms of the policy frameworks, we talked about 111D. Which is Section 111D of the Clean Air Act, and we will have final rules. We anticipate later this year the state will put together a plan by 2016, and we will comply with that plan. And what we have for the first time for the electrical sector is we will have carbon regulation on the books for the electrical sector nationally. PGE has been a proponent of federal action on climate policy, and now that we have 111D rules in place, we do have a federal carbon regime. So as we go forward and we're looking at issues that come up this legislative session, there are kind of two main things that we're looking for as we go through that short stack of some 1,400 bills that have been introduced and a couple of other LCs that we think are going to be coming forward. There are kind of two main things that we want to look for as we're evaluating those bills as we look at things from a carbon standpoint. Number one is, how do any bills or proposals that are put forward, how do those match up with the 111D standard? How does that work with 111D coming forward? This, as Jason said, we may be well situated unless something happens. I won't characterize things as potentially dumb, as Jason did, but not a bad point. And I think that there are some questions about what those final rules are going to look like, and we want to make sure that we're not doing something that makes it harder for us to comply as we have those final rules adopted on 111D. And then the second, as we look at proposals coming forward, and especially kind of things coming forward in front of this committee, is basic bang for the buck analysis. As we're looking at proposals for new projects or new programs, we want to make sure that we're being good stewards of resources and that if we're asked to buy something new or something more, that we're getting the highest return on investment possible out of those resources. I think one of the things that you're going to hear at different points is that the cost of renewable energy has come down. We want to, as we're making investments in new resources, be able to reap the benefit of lower cost projects and not necessarily looking at having to buy higher priced renewables relative to some of the other lower cost things that are on the market. We think that's just good, prudent investment. Then just two short points to close out. As we look forward to the rest of the session, there are two other things that we think have a role for the electric utilities we want to highlight. The first is workforce issues going forward. It's not necessarily the purview of this committee, but I think it's something important to talk about. As I look at Representative Reardon and Representative Johnson, I think both of you have talked quite a bit over time about career technical education and about the workforce that we need to have for the future. For PGE, as we have an aging workforce and we're needing to have new skilled workers, both skilled folks in the trades and engineers, we want to have Oregon workers be able to move into those roles, and so we think the CTE and the STEM work is pretty important, and I want to highlight that. And then also, I think that for us, looking in the areas of transportation and looking at economic development is something that we consider to be pretty important, and I think that it's not necessarily, again, the purview of this committee, but it's something y'all are going to be voting on, that the central assessment question and that issue that I know Chair Vega Peterson has taken some interest in and some leadership in, which we very much appreciate, to look at fixing some of the things in our tax law that are potentially an impediment to bringing new high-tech investment and some of the new data centers on that we think can contribute pretty favorably to the state. So thanks very much.
Okay. All right. So I'll try and fire this thing up.
We're fired up.
don't know.
There you go.
Hey, there we go. Oh, I'll let you drive.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, committee members, for the record, Scott Bolton on behalf of Pacific Corp. Thank you for the opportunity to come and participate in this hearing this afternoon. I know for the interest of time, I'll try and be quick, as I know we've covered a lot of ground already in the hearing. But Pacific Corp, we're a little bit of a different creature as it comes to the different energy providers, electricity providers here in Oregon. Pacific Corp was born out of the merger of Pacific Power and Light and Utah Power and Light back in 1989, and this is the business as it appears today. So we are a six-state utility, meaning that we provide retail service in Oregon, Washington, California, and we provide as a retail provider as Pacific Power, and in Idaho, Utah, and Wyoming as Rocky Mountain Power. And then we have a third unit called Pacific Corp Energy, which manages all of the triangles, squares, and dots and diamonds that you see on the map, which constitute our generation fleet. Basically, that adds up to about 11,000 megawatt portfolio. So it's quite large, serves about 1.8 million customers across those states. The generation portfolio is made up of kind of an all-the-above strategy where we have everything from hydropower to coal power to natural gas, wind, solar, and we're the largest biomass purchaser in the state of Oregon. And the vintages, frankly, run the lifespan of the company. The company is 105 years old this year, and we have hydroelectric projects that date back to the founding of the company, all the way to solar projects that are just a few years old. Our largest currently being the Black Cap Solar Project, within the city limits of Lakeview, Oregon. As you'll also see on this map, a lot of squiggly lines. Pacific Corp is the largest private transmission owner in the western U.S. We either own outright transmission, high voltage transmission systems, or have long-term capacity rights on other transmission lines. And that provides an enormous amount of flexibility and opportunity in reaching what is a very widely dispersed geographical customer base, as well as integrating a pretty diverse set of resources. It has also allowed us, as Jason Eisdorfer mentioned earlier in his presentation, our ability to participate in new market opportunities such as the energy imbalance market, where we're able to balance these resources using these transmission paths, marrying those up with supply and demand opportunities in California to better balance our system, not just reducing our reliance on having our own reserves and optimizing our transmission, but also, very importantly, and as I think we'll see as, frankly, the Western economy starts to transition to a lower carbon footprint, having the ability to absorb overgeneration from California as they ramp up their renewable program. There are periods of the day where California generates more solar than they can actually absorb within their grid. And having markets like the energy imbalance market available to absorb that not only helps optimize California's use of their system, but allows us to back down fossil resources and better integrate with our system as well. So we're doing some interesting things with, frankly, with legacy infrastructure, so doing new things with old stuff. Just an overview of Oregon. We have customers or assets in 31 of Oregon's 36 counties. Outside of a sliver of northeast Portland and a little bit of downtown, we're primarily a rural electricity provider in the state. We serve about 560,000 customers across the state and have about 27 customers per line mile. So contrast that with Portland General Electric, which is over 200 customers per line mile, and you can understand that we cover a lot of ground and have a lot of, frankly, infrastructure strung up to between population centers. It should also be noted just the relative size of the states that we serve just within the company. We have more customers just in the little blue area of Portland than we do in four counties in Northern California. So, again, policy really matters, and certainly the customer densities, we have all kinds of different experiences there. A lot was talked about earlier around integrated resource planning. This committee will hear a lot more about integrated resource planning as the session goes on. I won't get too much into this particular slide because the 2013 integrated resource plan, and this really represents our preferred least cost, least risk portfolio that emerged from that plan, is already stale. We're underway in our 2015 integrated resource plan. We were wrapping up stakeholder meetings last week. Didn't have time to update the slides. But basically what this shows is when you look at all the inputs, so all of the factors that were described earlier around what goes into an integrated resource plan, and you look at assumptions going forward around carbon regulation, natural gas prices, technology changes, what's going to happen with economic growth and load in your system. All of these different inputs ultimately turn into hundreds of different model runs of what the future could look like. And it's really through that process we establish, okay, based on what we know, what we think is going to happen, what is the plan that we should follow that best manages the business and risks for customers. And in 2013, this is really the path ahead. And if you look at this one, what you'll see is a pretty steady decline over time of coal resources as our coal fleet ages and we make, frankly, cost decisions around whether it makes sense to continue running those resources or switch to gas or even just take them offline altogether and look at can we backfill that capacity, frankly, through more efficiency or other resources. You'll see a growth in gas because, frankly, a commitment to wind and other renewables is a commitment to gas in order to integrate and balance that intermittent resources. And what you'll also see is a pretty big jump over time in energy efficiency. Now, we'll come back as the 2015 plan starts coming together because the 2015 plan is actually quite consequential because it's the first integrated resource plan that we run that has an overlay for the federal clean power plan or the 111D rule. So it's the first time we're factoring in basically an emissions reduction adjusted plan versus what we've done in the past. So there will be changes to this. No good plan doesn't change over time. But some of the things that we're already seeing and anticipating, frankly, is more energy efficiency than what we originally scoped out. So up to almost 60%+ more energy efficiency we're identifying going forward than where we were with the 2013 plan. And frankly, hundreds of megawatts of new renewables coming in that we didn't have in the 2013 plan, primarily solar coming in from the eastern side of our system. So a lot of things are changing, but frankly, that's to be expected when you're trying to look at 20-year horizons. I won't spend a lot of time on this slide, but basically this is what the emissions profile looks like against that 2013 plan. So as you'll see, even emissions reductions can be somewhat lumpy as you add or subtract different resources. As Jason, I think, appropriately identified, utility decisions, adding something or subtracting something usually is pretty lumpy, and you see those effects, particularly when you're looking at emissions. So I know you're going to have a clinic on the 111D rule, but just a few quick thoughts to part with around that. Because we run an integrated system, we don't run power plants, transmission lines for each state that we do business in. We operate regionally and we invest to maximize those resources across a wide region. We really do believe that the flexibility that's at least proposed within the 111D rule to be able to get states to work together is a really important aspect of that rule that we're encouraging our stakeholders, our state regulators, and we're working directly with federal officials on to try to really embrace. That is going to be the least cost way to meet the federal targets, at least for PacifiCorp, and we're we're optimistic that we can get there. We've got a lot of political and cultural issues to work through among our states, but we do think that if folks really saw what we see and how to best make this work, and that really is our approach to the Clean Power Plan, is to try to make it work, we think that's the right approach. And it really is built on things that we know. The building blocks around making plants more efficient, using coal plants less, using gas plants more, and doing what's called environmental redispatch, adding or utilizing and integrating renewable energy generation more, and certainly squeezing every bit of cost-effective energy efficiency we can find, really is the way that you reduce carbon emissions. And frankly, they're tried and true things that utilities have been doing for years, and frankly, we know how to do more of. So we have some comments to the EPA. We expect this summer to get a final rule. What I would probably my final comment on this is just to simply say, this is our reality. This is, you know, maybe to echo Varner's comments, we really are trying to work with all of our stakeholders across the states that we're in to understand that, you know, if not the Clean Power Plan, it will be something else. That we really do think that this framework is a reasonable one to work within, that, you know, with some adjustment, we think that we could get there. And we're certainly encouraging state legislatures and other policymakers to work with us to make it easier to achieve these rather than creating conflicting or other policies that may make it harder to navigate to get to that end goal. So with that, I'd be happy to take any questions. Thanks.
Representative Boone. Thank you, Madam Chair. Scott, this year, second to the last slide, I think, was the one that showed the mix of resources. And I'm just wondering why, as you went out to 2032, I think it was, if the coal plant's going to be closed down 2020, and why is hydro so small in that mix? Because it seems like the other, back on the first panel, the hydro was a much larger footprint.
Right. Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Boone. Yeah, we will have coal plant closures. We'll have one before the end of this quarter in 2015. We'll be closing a coal plant in Utah. By next year, early 2017, we'll be switching over a coal plant in Wyoming from coal to gas. We have flexibility, frankly, in how we manage our fossil fuel fleet. What we can't get more of is hydro. We have hydro, you know, as Crystal from Bonneville described, you know, the federal hydropower system is really for, intended by Act of Congress for direct power benefit for consumer-owned utilities. Investor-owned utilities do have hydro. We have a 585-megawatt plant up on the Lewis River, just, you know, 40 minutes north of Portland, which is the crown jewel of our hydro fleet. And we are relicensing those projects, trying to keep them upgraded and compliant with environmental regulations. And frankly, those are some of the oldest resources that we have are hydro, and hopefully, you know, some of the longest lived that we have. But acquiring new hydro is extremely difficult. Nobody's building new dams, and in fact, there's, you know, great pressure to take out existing dams. So hydro is one of those ones where it's great if you can get it. It's certainly, you know, from an environmental standpoint, one of the best baseload resources we can have, but our availability of adding more hydro is limited.
Quick follow-up. So would it count to, and I understand that, what you just said, can you do it without building a dam, like using turbines?
Yeah, Representative Boone, there's some ideas, some creative thinking going on out there around, you know, everything from where you just have water storage projects where they don't have electricity production, but you do have a considerable amount of water being stored behind a dam. Can you put a turbine in there, upgrade those facilities? There's some talk about that in some parts of the state. I think Bowman Dam outside of Prineville is one of those where I know Congress just change the wild and scenic designation on the Crooked River in order to accommodate the possibility of putting a generator into that dam. So those there's some incremental progress there. There's also some ideas around everything from running a turbine through sewer systems to looking at other types of run-a-river projects. What I would say is that the really large Big Bang hydro project, that era is probably over.
Yeah. I agree. Thanks.
Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee. Portland General Electric just brought on a sewer pipe, small project with Lucid Energy. Be interesting to see how that project performs. It's in the, to be fair, it's a drinking water pipe, not a sewage pipe. Probably should have said that more
That's
clearly.
It's not a crappy project.
Pardon?
So it's not a crappy project.
If I could defer the
environmental impact statement.
So let's go ahead. Gary, go ahead and state your name for the record.
Thank you. Chair Peterson, members of the committee, Gary Garr with Northwest Natural. What I'm going to try to do is actually give you an overview of kind of all the natural gas providers in Oregon, and not focus occasionally on us, but it'll be a little more of a broader. So Scott, can you flip us through?
There we go.
Next one. Next slide. Thanks. So there are three local distribution companies, as was pointed out in an earlier presentation, Avista, Cascade, and Northwest Natural. Avista serves approximately 97,000 customers in Oregon. You'll notice that they're primarily in southern Oregon and then over in eastern Oregon. Cascade serves 66,000 customers in central Oregon and then also in portions of eastern Oregon. Northwest Natural is primarily in the Willamette Valley I-5 corridor. We also go up the gorge and we're along the coast. As was pointed out on the map that Department of Energy showed, though, natural gas is kind of a fuel of choice, so we're not ubiquitous. We're not in all communities. And while our service territory may look like it's large and includes a lot of areas, we do have a number of communities which do not have natural gas frequently come to us asking for natural gas, and maybe at some point we'll be able to have an opportunity to discuss that issue, because it's a separate issue and one that is important for economic development to a lot of smaller communities. Moving on, there are three pipeline companies that serve Oregon. They're represented by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. The Ruby Pipeline is the newest pipeline. It's basically across the southern part of the state, very bottom part. It comes from the Rockies and primarily connects at Malind and delivers a lot of gas down into California. TransCanada's Gas Transmission Northwest starts up in Canada at Kingsgate, comes down through and then goes down through central Oregon. The Williams Northwest Pipeline is actually a number of pipelines serving from British Columbia as well as from the Rocky Mountains area, both and various coming through various states. For Northwest Natural, and actually for Oregon, it's kind of unique. It's one of the few states where you have a major population center that's served primarily by one pipeline. We get two-thirds of our gas, Northwest Natural, out of Canada, a third out of the Rockies. Primarily all comes across through the gorge and then down into Oregon on the Williams Pipeline, which basically, for lack of a better term, dead ends in southern Oregon. So that is one of the reasons, and I'll point out some other reasons, why we continue to look at other resources in terms of pipelines and other ways of providing some additional redundancy and capacity for the region. Next slide. So one of the things we do, since the current pipelines don't provide enough capacity to serve Oregon during the winter months, we use various storage facilities, and you'll notice the stars on the map are for underground storage facilities. Northwest Natural operates the Mist facility up in Northwest Oregon. We take gas, it's a depleted gas field, and we inject gas back into that field and store it. And we take the gas during the summertime when usage is low and draw out of that during the winter. Also on the gas system are some liquefied natural gas tanks. They're like a big thermos. You super chill the gas, you store it for visual purposes. A beach ball, which would be maybe normal gas, once you super cool it down for natural gas, it's about the size of a golf ball. We have, for Northwest Natural, we have one at Newport and one in Portland in the Linton area. And again, without those, wouldn't be able to provide service to our customers during winter. I'll quickly kind of mention on these two. As was pointed out, in terms of integrated resource plans, Northwest Natural also does one. One of the things we look at is how do we meet our loads going forward? Do we use storage? Do we create additional pipelines, energy efficiency? Can we use biogas, renewable gas? And those are all the types of things that we look at in our IRP. The next slide. Just kind of quickly show you kind of the how gas is used both in the residential. We have commercial industrial customers who buy what we call firm gas, which means they want gas year-round, 24 hours a day. We have interruptible customers. Those are customers who know that when it gets cold in the winter, we will call them up and tell them that they won't receive gas. That's also another way we manage our loads in order to have firm gas supplies for our residential commercial customers. And then we have transportation customers, and these are folks who go out and buy gas in the market just like we do, and then use our pipes in order to move gas to their facilities. Those are a lot of generally large industrial customers. And in that case, we also have firm transportation customers and interruptible transportation customers. Thanks, Scott. This one, actually, I was kind of surprised when I came across this slide. This is for 2013, but wanted to point out the increased use of natural gas in the generation side of the business for whether it's PacifiCorp or PGE. But in addition to the utilities, there are also independent energy suppliers that we have here in Oregon. There are on-site generators. We have customers, including Oregon State, that has on-site generation capabilities. And so the amount of gas that's being used in the power generation areas continues to grow dramatically. That creates a number of issues in the gas world in terms of the dispatch of how you dispatch gas. Gas is normally dispatched on like a day before. So we'll call up and tell them how much capacity we need in the pipeline. If you're a gas generating facility and you're trying to track wind or something like that, you aren't predicting that 24 hours in advance. And so we have issues related now to just the whole dispatch of natural gas, as well as actual gas pipeline capacity. So those are things within the region you're having more and more conversations about as to how do we provide enough natural gas infrastructure to provide both traditional gas supplies as well as the generation side. Next. And then I thought I'd point out the kind of the average kind of natural gas costs. To share with you just quickly for natural gas rates, our rates include kind of general costs of providing service, personnel, trucks, et cetera, the cost of investments, and then we have the price of gas. And the price of gas is passed on basically at wholesale. We don't mark it up. So annually, the Public Utility Commission will have us file with them our reports in terms of what it's going to cost us for gas, and the price then gets adjusted. Because of the abundant supply of natural gas, you'll notice that the price has been going down. It was mentioned that that's created some issues for renewable folks. At the same time, I will say that a recent national study reported because of that, it's basically disposable income per household in the United States is improved by $1,200 in 2012. Mm-hmm. That's projected to increase to $2,000 this year. And $3,500 by 2025. So there is also an upside, we think, for our customers and for Oregonians in the price of gas. Final slide. So a couple other just kind of quick things. I kind of wanted to point this out. Safety is a big issue for the entire industry. We focus on that. That's our number one issue. Northwest Natural has removed all of its cast iron pipe that's within our system, and by the end of next year, we'll have all of our bare steel out of our system. When you hear about a lot of the issues that happen on the East Coast, they have very old systems and a lot of infrastructure that needs to be replaced at the cost of hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars. We recently combined a couple of operations into a new facility at Sherwood, or a remodel facility at Sherwood. We built a training town that is kind of a state-of-the-art. It's one that we actually have a lot of other utilities coming to visit. It's we can simulate all kinds of incidents. We train folks. We share that with first responders, with other companies, and it's been proven very well. At the same facility, we also now have built a backup gas control center and a backup emergency operations center.
And then finally, just to touch base on a quick, some policy issues. Jason mentioned Senate Bill 844. That was last session. Allows us to invest in projects to reduce emissions. It will also benefit our customers. The commission just finished its rulemaking process at the end of the year. We are looking to try to file some projects with them probably beginning sometime in the second quarter. There will be a piece of legislation coming through. It passed out of the Senate Energy Committee yesterday, that makes a slight tweak to it. The purpose of the bill was to incent utilities. Everybody thinks that's what it does, but there was at least one attorney who questioned whether the wording was in the right paragraph. So we're just to make sure that works, we're going to move that one through. Some other things that we hope to do, maybe further discussions, would be the role of natural gas in the transportation sector, combined heat and power and other projects, as well as biomass projects, biogas projects. And with that, happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Thanks so much. I think those would sell as like hotcakes as tiny houses in the Portland area. So.
Actually, if I could.
Oh, yes. Go ahead.
I was just wondering, Gary, if that was kind of a model, if we do anything extreme or crazy, that's the only size house we'll be able to afford to live in for power in the Portland market.
Yeah. Representative Rubin. Well,
thank you for that extra spending money that we have available. Appreciate that. You mentioned the lack of redundancy in some of the pipelines, which I'm always concerned about, you know, maintaining that supply. Are there other concerns? You have like cyber crazies that any issues like that? None of that's come up really too much today in any of the discussions about the security of our transmission systems, our pipe systems. Any thoughts without giving away all your trade secrets?
Sure. Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Reardon. Yes, that is a large issue. We've got our own internal cybersecurity teams, as do the other utilities. It's a large focus. I'll tell you, on the congressional level, there's been considerable discussion, lots of involvement of utilities as well as other portions of infrastructure. Without going into detail, I will tell you that after a presentation we had last week at the company by the FBI on cybersecurity issues related to that, later in the day I got a call from our folks telling me my computer was trying to access my home modem from the office. And so we track. Let me just tell you, they track what's going on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Lerner, could you touch a little bit just on net metering? And the challenge, I think it's more so probably a PGE issue than a Pacific Corp, although maybe I'm wrong here, but I think in terms of the numbers of customers who would like to access that, just the challenges that it presents to PGE.
Vega Peterson, Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee. So net metering is it's an interesting discussion, and it's been in other parts of the country. It's become a little bit of a, I know there's the Mark Twain line about, you know, whiskey's for drinking, water's for fighting, and net metering might be for really big fights in some other states. And I think luckily in Oregon we take a generally much more collaborative approach. We work through things, and I think we've avoided having some of the conflicts that have occurred in other areas. I think that there are, when we talk about net metering, essentially what happens is if you're a customer who has a qualifying resource, generally speaking solar, rooftop solar on their house, and you're selling power, you're offsetting your load, and then for the generation that you have in excess of what you're using, or if it's generating during the day and your house is off, the power is flowing back onto the grid. And under Oregon statutes, generally the way net metering works is we pay the retail rate for net metering. So for us today, the retail rate in Portland General Electric service territory is 11.3 cents. So there are a couple of different things that come up as concerns. One is that over time, the cost of solar power has come down. Solar panels has decreased pretty significantly while the retail rate goes up. And so there's a question in terms of is the incentive of paying the retail rate the correct amount? If you've got a declining cost resource and the
the price that's being paid escalates over time as rate cases occur. The second is a question in terms of how do you recoup the full cost of the transmission and the distribution infrastructure. So in my bill at my house as a PGE customer, I'm paying not just for power. That's only a fraction of my bill, but I also pay for maintaining the distribution system and maintain the transmission system. So it's stunning, having being rookie at a utility, how often people drive cars into utility poles and knock them down. We have to have a crew go out and put them back up. Seems like just about every day somebody drives into a pole, knocks down, somebody's got to go back, put it back up. So, you know, there's costs that's incurred with that, replacing poles, et cetera. So if folks are being compensated at the retail rate, the question, the concerns that utilities around the country have raised is, are people paying for the full price of operating the system for those transmission, for those distribution resources? So I think that it's an area we've been doing internally a pretty deep look at net metering and about solar policy, and we've hired some smart folks to do some advising for us. The PUC is going to be doing a docket on the value of solar. There's a different approach that's been taken up nationally to look at the value of solar to appropriately value impacts on the distribution, both costs and benefits that could be applied to the distribution transmission systems for avoided new investments and for paying for those aspects, and looking at certain environmental attributes. And so I think that we expect this to be something active over at the PUC, and we think that's the appropriate place to be taking that on.
All right. Thank you guys so much. We have one more panel. And that is going to be Chuck Thurman from Monmouth Power and Light, and the Vice President of Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities Association, Ted Case from the Oregon Rural Electric Cooperative Association, Deborah Smith from Central Lincoln People's Utility District, and Jeff Bissonette from the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. As they're coming out, for those of you who are new on the committee, you may have thought that this committee gets over at quarter till five, but I'm going to follow in the steps of Representative Bailey and Representative Holby, and we will go till 5 p.m. as on a regular basis.
Wait.
Former chair Holby here. All right.
Gotta be excused.
Okay. We'll talk later. No. Thanks. Go ahead. Thank you so much for being here today. Go ahead and state your name for the record.
Chair Peterson, vice chairs, members of the committee. Excuse me. I'm Chuck Thurman, vice president of the Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities. I'll refer to that as OMEU in my presentation. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today and provide an overview of our municipal electric utilities here in Oregon. 11 of the Oregon municipally owned and operated utilities joined to form OMEU via an intergovernmental agreement authorized by Oregon Revised Statute 190. OMEU supports the collective interests of its members and their customer owners at state legislators, state agencies, various trade associations, and the BPA. A 12th municipally owned electric utility, Eugene Water and Electric Board, has its own representation, so it is not represented by Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities. If you'll please put up or look at Exhibit A that I have distributed to you, that shows each of the electric municipal utilities and their dates of incorporation. You'll notice some of them back in the 1800s all the way to 2001. Municipally owned electric utilities are governed by the City Council or the Utility Board, comprised of community members who set the rates, regulatory policies, develop programs and services, and respond to the specific customer needs with the primary focus of delivering safe, reliable, and affordable electricity. As far as the resource mix, we obtain most of our power from Bonneville Power Association. A few members independently obtain a small amount of hydropower from Grant County in Washington, that would be Minville Water and Light in River Bend landfill that they have. They generate enough from the landfill to help about 2,500 homes and businesses, which is equivalent to about 4 megawatts. That's pretty substantial. In 1981, the city of Ashland passed one of the first citywide solar access protection ordinances in the United States. Ashland purchases about 98% of their power from Bonneville, a little bit from solar, and 2% is hydro at Reed. Forest Grove, a municipal electric utility, installed solar on their utility building, which powers city electric vehicles. I'm proud to say in the city of Monmouth, of which we also have 100% AMR, automated meter reading, we are now 50% complete in our LED installation of street lights and the LED installation in our new police department. So we are taking energy efficiency very seriously. Each utility responds to its customers' needs and aspirations through its local volunteer governing body. Over the next 5 years, renewable standards, distributed generation, electric vehicles, smart meters, and smart grid are issues with each local governing body, which we'll have to explore and study to make the best informed policy decisions for our communities, balancing policy leadership with affordable power. In conclusion, Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities are the epitome of local control and responsibility. For example, when a single parent struggling to pay their power bill, they can walk right into our offices. They are our neighbors. They're the ones we see at the grocery stores. And we can work with them face to face. It's that more personal touch that we can have with them. The integrity of our systems, both financial and structural, is strong because we are directly accountable to our customers. More specifically, our governing bodies are accountable to their neighbors and our fellow citizens. Thank you for your time and attention, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ted Case. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Rural Electric Cooperative Association. We represent 18 electric co-ops in the state, serve about 200,000 members in some of the most rural and remote parts of the state, and I'll talk about one of them at the end. You've heard a lot about the resource mix today from Chuck and from Crystal Ball. We are 95% emission-free because of the power we get from the Bonneville Power Administration. Representative Peterson, Vega Peterson, I'd love to have you up at the Bonneville Dam this summer, and you saw what we're doing on fish and wildlife. And I know Representative Bentz asked that question about the fish and wildlife programs. We have spent $13 billion on those programs. I'm happy to say that even though that is a tremendous amount of money, those programs are working. We are getting record returns of fish. In fact, we had 2.5 million adult salmon return up the dams last year. On one day, we had 65,000 come through Bonneville Dam, which was a record. The next day, 66,000 came through. So just an amazing return, but it is very costly, and we do expect that those costs will continue. We are leaders in energy efficiency. As Crystal Ball noted, we do get a target from the Northwest Power Conservation Council, and we always exceed that target. In fact, we smash through that target. We are leaders in energy efficiency. I do go out from time to time with some of the energy efficiency experts from electric co-ops and go into these homes with them, and I look at the files that they have from these homes, and they've been in these houses sometimes five or six times over the decade. We're doing windows or heat pumps, so there is a very close relationship with our customers on energy efficiency. We're leaders in renewable energy. We've done, in addition to the hydro from the Bonneville system, and we do consider hydro to be renewable. We've been involved in landfill gas. We've just built a geothermal plant down in Lake County. We're very excited about that. And we're looking at community solar. We're very interested in that. We have several co-ops that will be deploying community solar next year, so you'll be hearing more about that from me. We have about 80% penetration of smart meters in the state. Electric co-ops actually lead the nation in the deployment of smart meters. Some people are surprised to hear that, but it does give our consumers more control of their power bill. They get notices when their bill's going to be higher than normal and things like that, and they like that control. They like to look at it daily. That's not something I'm interested in, but that some people really like to look at their power bills daily. But let me just conclude by saying we really can't overlook the rural nature of our service territory. We are rural utilities. Sometimes our ratio is one customer per mile of line. And whenever I need a reality check about that, I go out to places like Columbia Power, which is headquartered in Monument, Oregon, which is about 5 hours from here in Grant County. Representative Bentz probably knows the way, but it's pretty far out there. It's the headquarters of Columbia Power. It's got about 125 people in the town. The co-op serves about 1,000 people. There's no industry, and there probably won't be. There's no load growth. Nobody's coming to town. There's no hospital. There's no highway or anything like that, but they're Oregonian just like the rest of us. And so their biggest load is the school, K through 12, and there's 40 kids in the school. And if you're the third grade teacher, you're kind of lonely because there are no kids in third grade. But that's the people that I represent, and those are the people that I have to look out for. And so as you debate this year on a lot of the issues you're going to grapple with, I hope you think about them too. So thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Deborah.
Thank you. Chair Vega Peterson and members of the committee, my name is Deborah Smith, and I'm the general manager of Central Lincoln PUD. So in Oregon, PUDs are people's utility districts. In Washington, they're public utility districts. That's an important distinction because the people vote to create the PUD. So we have boards. The five PUDs that are members of OPUDA, the Oregon PUD Association, all have boards who are elected by the people they serve. And like the folks here, we largely serve rural populations, and they are people who, in many cases, are far more economically disadvantaged than other parts of Oregon. So we have directors who are voted in by people in the specific communities. My utility, for instance, covers a geographical area that's 120 miles north-south along the Oregon coast. And so we have a representative in Reedsport, and we have a representative in Newport, and they deal with really different issues for the community populations that they represent. And that's true of many of the PUDs. So I like to say we've heard a lot about who's number one, two, three. I'm number four. I'm proud to be the fourth largest electric utility in Oregon and quite a bit smaller than number three. But so we're small but mighty. Two-thirds of the Oregon coast, again, is covered by PUDs, and we the PUD utilities, we are present in parts of, I have to look at my list so I don't forget anybody, Lincoln, Tillamook, parts of Columbia, Multnomah, Lane, Douglas, Coos, and Wasco counties. So we're kind of all over the state. We are about rates. We are responsive to those customers who have limited means, and so we work very hard to maintain rates, and we work very hard to have strong community connections. We're the folks, one of our PUDs does a spaghetti feed every year. These are the kinds of things that PUDs do in order to stay connected to their community owners. So about 196,000 people are served by Oregon's PUDs, or the PUDs represented by OPUDA, and we deliver over 4 million megawatt hours per year. 400 family wage jobs that are worth about $47 million per year in salary and benefits. Some of these jobs are some of the highest paying and the best family wage jobs in the communities that we're serving. We pay property taxes and franchise fees, and in 2013, OPUDA Utilities paid over $8 million in property taxes and franchise fees, again, to the communities that we serve. We've already talked about the Bonneville Power, so we're right there. It's funny, you say 95, I say 96. Is that like tomato, tomato? I don't know.
I'll take your number.
Okay, so it's a great carbon-free resource, and we're thankful to Bonneville and to Crystal for providing that to us. And like Ted and like the co-op, some of our utilities also are involved in their own generation sources. And so we have cogen, wood waste, biomass, agricultural waste, landfill gas, and fish-friendly hydro. So we have utilities that are full requirements customers, and we have utilities who are also doing some of their own thing. We work hard to make our products affordable for our rural communities. That includes investing in energy efficiency, conservation, and cumulatively, we have invested $46 million in energy efficiency and conservation, saving more than 200 million kilowatt hours. So cost to customers, again, that's the most important thing to us. And so a couple things that we worry about. We worry about the energy supplier assessment. And in the past, the PUDs have been pretty vocal about that. We want to make sure that it's something that is controllable and understandable, and we hope that that's something that you'll be looking at this year. We've also, OPUDA has been vocally opposed to the low-carbon fuel standard, and we understand that that's a big deal this year. And for us, it really comes down to the fact that as rural utilities, fuel costs are a big part of our budget, and we don't have alternative transportation, and we spend a lot of time behind our windshields. I spend a lot of time behind my windshield. So the cost of fuel is a big driver for rural utilities. Oregon's made significant investments in conservation, has achieved tremendous energy savings, and has already deployed the highest concentration of renewable generation in the country through the Pacific Northwest's Columbia Snake River Federal Hydropower System. So Oregon PUDs are eager here to serve as a resource for you as you engage some of these issues, especially those of you who are new to the committee. We have good people who work hard and really enjoy living in these smaller, more rural communities, and we can help you provide feedback, information, and help craft a balanced long-term energy plan for this state, and we hope that you'll give us the opportunity to do so.
Thank you so much, Deborah. Questions for this panel? Representative Reardon.
A real short one. I'm with all the, you know, majority of your power coming from hydro, which is that still a low cost?
Okay. Yes, hydro.
So what motivates you to invest in alternative fuels, alternatives?
That's a good question. So my utility, for instance, does not, but the utility I worked for before I came to work here was a municipal who owns and serves much of a good chunk of load with locally owned generation. I think it's around diversification. I think it's around local control. And I think when we're investing in renewables, we're doing so with a long-term vision. And we're knowing that while hydro is very clean and hydro is very cost-effective, we also live in a community where people are really interested in other resources and other choices, and we have an obligation, I think, to help invest in and help develop those renewable, alternative renewable resources. So, you know, in my service territory, for instance, it's all about wave power, and wave power is probably, you know, something who, you know, we are probably some years away from that being a viable, certainly an economically viable resource, but we're all committed to it because we understand that at some point in time, it could be something huge for our state and huge for our economy, and we have an obligation to be part of bringing that home.
One real, I just swear.
Follow up.
So how much did the RPS fit into your...
So for us, again, where we sit, most of us, I think I am the highest, I'm the next utility. So when we talked about number four, so you had PacifiCorp, PGE, and EWEB, who had the higher renewable standard, and then I fall into that next group. So we're able to meet all of our RPS requirements through RECs that are provided through Bonneville, et cetera. We have a long view on RECs, but we're also a community or a service territory that I serve that has very little growth. So I think you mentioned we don't have new industry coming to the coast at this point in time. So I'm fairly comfortable that I can meet my RPS requirements with resources that are in hand. But you have other places. I think you have a co-op, a member, who has been experiencing more growth, and that's been a bigger issue. So for Umatilla, for instance, and I think that's a...
Madam Chair, Representative Reardon, we have a RPS compliance. Most of the co-ops is going to be 5% by 2025, and we will meet that primarily through the RECs that we get from the hydro upgrades. Umatilla Electric Cooperative is a different animal altogether because of the incredible load growth that they've had because of the data center, so there'll be a higher standard on there.
Okay. Thank you.
And I think one of the interesting things, talking about the data centers, are a lot of them are looking at also clean energy investments, too. Some of them are, so that will be a topic that I know we've been discussing around the central assessment discussion, too. So that's there. Other questions? Great. Thank you so much for coming today. Thank you, everyone, for your time and attention. Oh, my gosh, Jeff, I'm so sorry.
You get 1.5 minutes.
Yes. I thought you were...
I dodged the bullet.
Yeah, no. No, we're going to be coming up here. Okay. Please introduce yourself for the record. Sorry about that.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Bissonnette with the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. I represent residential ratepayers. We're a 30-year old organization, so what I thought I'd do is give a sort of overview of the last 30 years of energy policy, and I have a 113 slide presentation to do that I can do in about 60 slides. In seriousness, I will just take a couple of minutes because over the course of the session, we'll be spending a lot of time together, and so I don't want to take all of the time now, but I will just say a couple of things. I think you can see by all of the presentations, whether one represents a utility or a government agency, the customers of a utility in terms of the
consumer-owned utilities or a residential ratepayer, we all take our role in sort of energy and energy policy and energy system very seriously and very passionately. And so you will hear a lot of debate, a lot of vigorous arguments, but we all are really trying to figure out the best way forward for Oregonians and really trying to establish and keep our progressive energy policy tradition that we have. As a ratepayer advocate, we are take very seriously the least cost, least risk approach that Jason Eisdorfer talked about from the PUC. But we are also very concerned that the right investments get made. And so it makes a lot of sense to pay a little bit more now for energy efficiency because it's going to save us a lot in the long run. It makes sense now to pay for renewables because over time the fuel costs are negligible. And those are good investments going forward. So we are not a low rates at all cost organization, but we really look at the value of what ratepayers are getting through the rates that they're getting paid, and that is really the focus that we bring to these debates. And you saw the list of policies and bills that have been talked about over time. We've been involved in all of those, and we are involved in many of the dockets at the PUC. So over the course of the next several months, again, be talking to all of you as a group and individually, and we look forward to the discussions that are coming. Thanks.
Nicely done.
Yes, very good.
Wow.
Questions for Jeff? Thank you so much. With that, we will, anything else for the record that we need? Okay. Thank you, everyone, for your time and attention. We will see you on Thursday at 3 p.m. With that, I'll close the hearing.
Yeah. Have a good time.
Yeah.
Have a good time.
With that, I'll close the hearing.